Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our November 10th, 9 a.m. service. Our guest speaker is Reverend Michael Dowd. His sermon title is, Not the Future We Ordered, Honoring Our Grief. The music following the sermon is Allegretto from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 8, performed by Akui Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
Our reading this morning is by Wendell Berry. If we will have the wisdom to survive, to stand like slow-growing trees on a ruined place, renewing it, enriching it, if we will make our seasons welcome here, asking not too much of earth or heaven, then, a long time after we are dead, the lives our lives prepare will live here, their houses strongly placed upon the valley's fields, gardens rich in the windows. The river will run clear as we will never know it, and over it, birdsong like a canopy. On the levels of the hills will be green meadows, stock bells in noon shade. On the steeps where greed and ignorance cut down the old forest, a new forest will stand, its rich leaf fall drifting on its roots. The veins of forgotten springs will have opened. Families will be singing in the fields. In their voices, they will hear a music risen out of the ground. They will take nothing from the ground. They will not return, whatever the grief at parting. Memory, native to this valley, will spread over it like a grove, and memory will grow into legend, legend into song, song into sacrament. The abundance of this place, the song of its people and its birds will be health and wisdom and indwelling light. This is no paradisal dream. Its hardship is its possibility. So ends the reading.
Good morning. I'd like to begin with two quotes that relate to this theme of not the future we ordered, honoring our grief. Clarissa Pinkola Estes writes, "Do not lose heart. We were made for these times." Alice O'Keefe writes, "Even if we can't escape its consequences, it is not too late to escape the mindset that brought us here." I love the quote earlier that was up there that's also in your bulletin by Joanna Macy. "The measure of your grief is the measure of your love," or "The depth of your grief is the measure of your love." I'd like to speak this morning just briefly about sort of the big picture, how we got here, where did we come from, where are we going, and how do we know, like what gives us confidence in that, and then how are we to live? And I want to do that in about 15 minutes, so we'll see where we go. This theme of not the future we ordered, it's vital because it turns out there are three shapes of time. When we think of the whole of human history, if we go back, say, to Homo habilis, walking upright using stone tools, we're talking about 2.5 million years ago. And then we've used symbolic language, we've spoken in these symbols that point to a reality beyond what they can capture in any definitive way, really only for the last 400, 500,000 years, 500,000 years or so. And there are two major distinctions that we now understand through science about the nature of humans living in the world. Human cultures have typically, for the first 97% of human history, we lived in what could be called pro-future cultures. That is, we lived in cultures that lived in scale, in place, and in ways that ensured that future generations could thrive. That's what a pro-future culture is. Pro-future is also pro-nature. It's relating in a mutually enhancing relationship with primary reality. That is, with everything we need to survive and thrive. Soil, forests, water, life, other species. A certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere, but not too much. And so human beings weren't capable of impacting some systems in ways that we are now. But if we don't understand the distinction between cultures that live in a way that is honoring of the seventh generation, turns out that living in the present with the seventh generation in mind isn't just a good idea. To do otherwise is evil. So anti-future cultures tend to be human-centered. In fact, before I even say anything about anti-future cultures, let me just flesh out a little bit pro-future cultures. So for the first 97 to 99% of human history, depending upon if you start with Homo habilis or Homo sapiens, but for the first vast majority of human history, we lived with a sense of the divine that was alive. In other words, the biosphere was a greater thou, not a lesser it. Whatever all the differences that indigenous cultures had, they all related to the living world as a greater thou, not a lesser it. They related with a sense of humility before primary reality. And they took care of the well-being of primary reality as a sacred responsibility. Sacred simply meaning it can't be bought or sold. It's more important than us. It's one of the reasons why we have no evidence in human history of a market-based economy that didn't self-destruct. Because market-based economies tend to treat primary reality as lesser its that simply can be brought into the human realm, transformed however we want, and then go to the waste heap. So, primary reality is related to as primary in pro-future cultures. In fact, it turns out religion or life ways, it wasn't called religion. In fact, one of the things you can be sure of is you're living in an anti-future culture if religion is simply one aspect of society sort of over here. But what's really important is the economy or politics or all sorts of other things. So it turns out that in pro-future cultures, there's a sense of life ways. It wasn't called religion, it was life ways. And life ways, this is common throughout indigenous first peoples. The role of religion is to ensure accountability to the future. It's to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present. And that's done by primarily honoring limits. There's a limit to how much we can take from the living world and a limit to how much waste we can exude to the living world before the systems start breaking down. In the ecological language, it's called overshoot. That is, there is a carrying capacity to any bioregion, any island, any continent, and the planet. There's a carrying capacity. That is, there's a limit to how much we can take and how much we can exude. And when you overshoot the carrying capacity, you're now into much more difficult energy, and you've degraded the forests and the soil and the other life, and so your civilization contracts. It turns out that over the last 6,000 years, we know of over 100 civilizations that have come and gone. That is 100 city-based, human-centered, anthropocentric civilizations that all self-destruct. There's not one example that didn't. Because human-centeredness is self-destructive. Only life-centeredness is sustainable. If we measure progress and well-being by how well individuals, or in some cases very wealthy individuals and corporations, do, then that's human-centered. It's anthropocentric, and it's unsustainable. So what happens is civilizations become great. The elite often will start to co-opt the religion, so the religion really no longer can ensure accountability of the future. So rather than being the control mechanism, that is that aspect of society that speaks with moral authority, that we need to honor the future as a sacred responsibility and honor the living world as a sacred responsibility, the elite start gathering resources to themselves, and the society achieves overshoot and then contracts and collapse. And typically it takes about half the time to collapse as it does to become great. So if it takes 2 or 3 centuries to become great, it'll take a half a century to a century and a half to collapse. And we see this over and over and over again. And there have been historians like Arnold Toynbee and Oswald Spengler, Giambattista Vico. More recently, people like John Michael Greer has popularized them. And they set societies side by side by side, both sustainable pro-future societies or cultures and unsustainable self-destructive cultures, and notice the patterns, the common patterns. Turns out that on the way up, they're very different and create hugely different things. And on the way down, the parallels are stunningly common. John Michael Greer calls one of them the senility of the elites. The elites lose touch with where the vast majority of the people are, and the power and wealth becomes mega concentrated in a smaller number. The middle class kind of washes out. Virtually everybody becomes poor until the society collapses or until the elites end up as lamppost decorations. So when we look at pro-future cultures, there's a lot that we can learn, but one of the most important things we can learn, because we're living in an anti-future culture, we're living in an unsustainable civilization, and anything that is unsustainable at some point won't be sustained. That means it's going to end. So honoring this sense of grief is to recognize that there are three shapes of time. If you're born in a pro-future society, there's not a sense of change over time. In fact, there's a profound sense of continuity, that you pass on the wisdom from your ancestors of how to live sustainably, and you faithfully pass that on to your descendants, because it is sacred, it's holy, it's the most important thing. But once we get into human-centered cultures these last 6,000 or 7,000 years and we go into this boom and bust pattern, if you're born in times of expanding possibilities, more and more energy, incredible forests, lots of food, whatever, things are great and liberal values tend to predominate. And then when you've reached overshoot and you start getting in contracting times and the forests are wiped out, the soil washes away, or in the case of coal, oil, and natural gas, we're now into the dirtier, harder to get, much more difficult stuff, and we're changing the atmosphere, which is, of course, melting the glaciers. Had dinner with Dar Jamel last night and Barbara Cecil. I know they'll be speaking here. Dar Jamel spoke here not long ago. And so we're living in that time of contraction. And it turns out that liberal values tend to predominate in expanding economies and expanding times of carrying capacity surplus, where there's more than enough. In times of contraction, conservative values tend to predominate. Schisms that used to be a big deal back then and then kind of were no big deal for a while because the pie was growing bigger, so there was always a bigger slice. In contracting times, those schisms come back. And in-group, out-group tightening. So long-standing feuds and all this kind of schisms. And this is what we're seeing. Part of the senility of the elites is in democratic institutions, we see precisely the kind of elections that we've recently had and precisely the kinds of insanity that we are currently experiencing. And it turns out that if you're born in expanding times, you live your whole life there, it's great. Progress is inevitable. Progress is a fact, not a belief. And if you're living in times, and you were born and live your whole life in times of contraction, regression is inevitable. It's a fact. It's not a belief. Progress is an illusion. Everybody knows it. The most difficult time is when we're born in times of a carrying capacity surplus, and in our lifetime it shifts. And we live in declining times, contracting times, more chaotic times. This is a time of more and more. This is a time of less and less. And if you're born into this, and this is what you experience before you die, it's hard, it's difficult, it's painful, it's grieving, we get angry. The stages of grief are not just about individuals. I had to deal with the death of a worldview. When I preached here last, it was 2003, it was early on in our ministry. And my worldview at that time was still very techno-optimist. I believed that technology and the market were going to have this unending progress forever. I was deluded because I didn't understand energy and ecology. I didn't understand that technology, when you step back and look at the whole history of technology, human-centered technologies, that is, technologies that benefit us but don't help any other species, always, always, always cause more problems than they solve. They just do it over time. So the idea that, you know, we're going to live on Mars or mine asteroids and be able to keep living this wasteful lifestyle is utterly insane. And yet a lot of people believe that because it is psychologically painful to accept contraction if much of your life has been experiencing expansion. So not the future we ordered is the recognition that life, reality, is divine, and reality speaks through evidence, not primarily through old men and old books. And reality is telling us some really profound and important things about how to live in right relationship to reality, right relationship to life, even in contracting times. Because it's quite possible that human beings will survive this bottleneck of climate and all the other devastating things. I'm not going to go into all that. And we could last another 2 or 3 million years before an asteroid or a supervolcano or something takes us out. No mammal our size lasts more than about 5 million years max, usually not that. And then life will continue. Earth will continue to spin on its axis. The moon will continue to go around. The Milky Way, everything. Species will come. Species will go. Climate will change. Glaciers will come. Glaciers will go. See, that's the thing about when you understand evidence as authoritative, you realize it's not all about us. We get back to the kinds of indigenous wisdom that realized it's all about life, not about us. In fact, human-centeredness is the essence of what religious people call idolatry. Idolatry isn't bowing down to statues. Idolatry isn't believing in the wrong god. Idolatry is having a arrogant, hubris relationship to primary reality. The land belongs to us. Man, conqueror of nature. That's idolatry. So winding this down, how do we survive and thrive? How do we have healthy relationships? How do we have joy, true joy, in the midst of contraction? Well, it turns out we actually have quite a bit of evidence on how to do that. And part of it is downshifting, downscaling. It's using less energy, driving less, composting, recycling. No, it's not going to save the world. Industrialism is still going to hit the wall. And humans might go extinct in the next 100 years. There's no question that that's possible. But we can still have vibrant lives. See, here's the thing, and I tell this with young people when I speak to families, parents especially, is that when you look at previous civilizations, heroes and sheroes, that is, people who become the saints and sages that future generations mythologize and talk about like in reverential terms, are almost always born in times of contraction and collapse. So this is a time when heroes and sheroes, it's like a womb in that brings to birth the saints and sages of future generations. But not only that, the saints and sages of our own neighborhoods. Every neighborhood in contracting times, again, we learn this from the Great Depression. If you study the Great Depression and other times of contraction, even temporary, you realize that there are people that the neighborhood, that the community held in such high esteem, and they were always about service. It was always about love incarnate. It was always about being a blessing to others in your community. And when I say downshifting, we're all going to have to downshift anyway. John Michael Greer, one of our favorite authors, has a book called Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush. You know, collapse now and avoid the rush. In other words, it's choosing to downshift, but doing so knowing that, oh, this is what happens in contracting civilizations. See, when you understand this, when you realize what reality is telling us through evidence, and you understand these patterns, you can step back. And when the last election happened, instead of going, oh no, this shouldn't be, you understand and you say, yeah, it hurts like hell and it's right on schedule. Because you understand. And then your activism, your engagement in your community is not from the place of frenetic fear and just bitter anger. And those are normal, healthy feelings. Allow yourself to feel them if they're there for you. But ultimately, you quickly get to the place of compassion and generosity because you have some understanding. So one of the most important things, recognizing that we were all born in times of carrying capacity surplus, we're now living in times of carrying capacity deficit, and one of the greatest challenges of our time is the recognition that the entire world wants to live like middle-class Americans, and that's what they're being sold. That's what the TV and all various media. People in Bangladesh, India, China, all over the world, they expect if they just keep buying into the, you know, industrial paradigm, neoliberalism, they're going to be able to live like middle-class Americans. It would take 10 planets of resources to provide that much energy and resources and absorb that much waste. It's not going to happen. So we're living in a time that can be experienced and usually is for most of us that wake up to it as depressing or overwhelming or just, oh my gosh, no, because we live for so many decades in this kind of a world. So downshift, build community, plant trees. One of the most holy things that we can do is take seeds of trees and plants, whatever your favorite plants are. Plants have been migrating north and south for millions of years with the glaciers. So it's not invasive, as long as you don't move it across continents and stuff. And so to take plants, seeds, and plant them further north so they're heat adapted, you're assisting trees in migrating because trees don't have legs. They can't move. Turns out that the difference between thousands of plants and canopy trees going extinct in the next 100 years or not will depend on humans assisting them in migrating. Planting trees, helping them migrate, building topsoil, strengthening community, and downshifting in any ways that you can is holy work. And especially to stand with young people. It goes beyond all the important social justice concerns. It's also intergenerational justice. And right now, young people are waking up to that. And it's important for we olders and elders to stand with young people in their fight for intergenerational justice. Is it going to make the difference? Are we going to transform the systems? Are all of the beliefs that young people, some young people have in terms of what's possible, realistic? Probably not. It doesn't matter. It's still holy work to stand with them in their fight for intergenerational justice and to help them realize that this is precisely the kind of climate, broadly speaking and narrowly speaking, where greatness is born, where heroes and sheroes are born. And so any skill that you have, any knowledge that you have that can be passed on to a young person, apprentice them, mentor them, it's holy, holy work. I mentioned to Reverend Kate that Connie and I will be on Whidbey Island until mid-February. Normally, I always offer an hour-long evening program following, but you all have such stuff, amazing, wonderful stuff going on that we didn't schedule that. So if that gets scheduled, great. But if not, one of the things that we've been doing now for a couple of years is making sure that all the best books and videos that are available in this movement, if you want to share this stuff with others, so we have a flash drive that if you get either the video or the audio flash drive, loan it out to a dozen of your friends and neighbors and family and let them drag and drop the entire contents. It's the best videos that we've ever created and the best audio books, like scriptures. I call it deep sustainability scripture. So I'd like to conclude with a quote from Joanna Macy. This is a dark time, filled with suffering and uncertainty. Like living cells in a larger body, it's natural that we feel the trauma of our world. So don't be afraid of the anguish you feel, or the anger or fear, because these responses arise from the depth of your caring and the truth of your interconnectedness with all beings. You don't need to do everything. Do what calls your heart. Effective action comes from love. It is unstoppable, and it is enough.